more. "Please, repeat after me," the digital voice said. "Lucy Lockett lost her pocket. Sally Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, just a ribbon round it." She could taste blood in her mouth this time. The man's violence terrified her. She now knew what she had seen in his eyes that was so unsettling. The man was a killer, and as sure as she was standing there, if he felt her life needed to be ended, he would do it. "Please let me get this right. Please, God, let me get it right. I just want to leave. I just want to go home. Lucy Lockett lost her pocket. Sally Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, just a ribbon round it," she said, picking up speed right at the end, as she knew she had it. The man in the mask gestured for her to do it again. She did, and with more confidence. "Lucy Lockett lost her pocket. Sally Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, just a ribbon round it." The man in the mask tucked the digital recorder into the pocket of his coveralls, brought his gloved hands together, and politely clapped. The muffled sound echoed in the hard, cold space. He stood there looking at her, almost appraising her. Then, he slowly extended his left hand and placed it gently on her shoulder. No sooner had her mind formed the words, "He's trying to reassure me. They're going to let me go," than his hand drew back with an explosion of force that took her blouse with it. Chapter 55. Without access to the books in his home library, Harvath had to make do with what was available on the internet. Hanging a map of Boston on the wall in Cordero's office, they used colored pushpins and thumbtacks to mark every location of interest to them. Seeing everything displayed on the wall helped them take in the big picture. The only outlier was the murder of Claire Marcourt on Jekyll Island, Georgia. A photo of Jekyll Island was printed out on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper and taped to the wall next to the lower right-hand corner of the Boston map. This way, they had visual access to everything. Not only was their map awash in pins, marking the sites of historic events, they had no idea which direction in time the killer was going to move in next. On a whiteboard set up on an easel, Harvath drew a timeline and walked Cordero through it, as much for his own thought process as for hers. "The first murder happened Sunday night on Jekyll Island and incorporated elements of the Pine Tree Riot from New Hampshire in 1772, he said, sticking a pin above the map to represent New Hampshire. Coming back to the easel, he continued. "The second murder then took place in Boston, late Monday night, early Tuesday morning, at the Liberty Tree site, and mimicked the hanging of Andrew Oliver in effigy in 1765. So, we moved backward in time. The third murder then took place in Boston's North End last night, the site where then-Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson had his house sacked and destroyed, also in 1765. Just shy of 2 weeks, in fact, after his brother-in-law, Andrew Oliver, was hung in effigy." "Well, let's assume for a moment," said Cordero, studying everything, "that whoever the Sons of Liberty are, they wanted their first murder to be big, symbolic, and aimed unmistakably at the Fed. That's why it happened on Jekyll. If they had wanted to kill Claire Marcourt in Boston, they could have brought her here the same way they did Peter Whalen from Chicago, right?" Harvath nodded. "Sure. So, let's assume Jekyll Island as a location, as well as the elements of the murder, were all meant for shock and awe."
"Okay."
"If that's the case, it's the exception, and what we've seen in Boston becomes more of the rule. The Liberty Tree to the site of the Hutchinson Mansion shows the killer moving chronologically."
"You're not wrong," Harvath said. "It just isn't enough to build a foundation on."
"We have no choice. The absence of additional corroborative data doesn't mean the data we have is incorrect. It's like I told you. We're building a watch. Right now, I have two gears that fit together. It's illogical to sit here and not pair those gears up and try to go to the next step." It took a special mind to do this kind of work. As much as Harvath prided himself on his patience and self-control, he realized that Cordero had a unique talent for this kind of work. It was an area in which he was definitely at a deficit.
"All right," he replied. "Let's marry up our two gears. Let's assume for a moment that our killer is now moving forward chronologically. What kind of thing are we looking for next? Is it a big historical headline, or still significant but more nuanced?
Now Cordero was out of her depth.
You're asking me? She said. I thought we already established my less-than-stellar aptitude in all things historically Boston.
What's your gut tell you?
My underinformed gut?
Harvath shook his head.
No, your homicide cop gut. Whoever is behind this, they've got two more potential victims. Do they go big symbolism-wise, or do they play small ball?
If we literally let history be our guide, what do they have available to them?
It was a good question. Taking a different color dry erase marker, Harvath referred back to the American History website he had pulled up and drew a new timeline.
In 1767, he said, the British Parliament passes the Townshend Acts, essentially a tax on tea, paper, glass, and lead in the colonies. It creates more cries of no taxation without representation in the colonies, and the colonists boycott British goods. One of the real rubs, though, is that Townshend allows for the quartering of British troops in colonial homes and businesses, which brings us to 1768. In 1768, the Sons of Liberty issue a very serious threat of armed resistance if any British troops show up. Shortly thereafter, two regiments appear in Boston to help collect taxes. Many colonists see this as the beginning of the British occupation of Boston.
Do we know where they were housed? Cordero asked.
Harvath had been working on her computer and had multiple windows open. It took him a minute or two to find the information he was looking for.
Here it is, he said. One regiment set up camp in Boston Common, the other at Faneuil Hall,
which we passed last night after dinner.
He remembered. It had been a marketplace and meeting hall where Sam Adams and others gave fiery speeches, encouraging the colonies to break away from Great Britain.
Seeing as how it has been called the Cradle of Liberty by some, said Harvath, I can see where it might make an attractive backdrop for our killer.
Let's put it on our list, she replied. What else do we have?
Before Harvath could reply, Cordero's commander hastily stuck his head in the office. We just got word that we may have gotten a hit on the missing persons bulletin from this morning.
Someone spotted Renner and Mitchell, said Harvath.
Not specifically.
What do you mean?
We got a report of suspicious activity in an old warehouse near Cabot Yard.
Harvath looked at Cordero.
Where's that?
Southie, she replied. What kind of suspicious activity?
Two patrol officers pinched a metal thief. He'd been stripping abandoned buildings in the area. He's got felonies on his sheet, and they caught him in possession of a weapon. That means he's looking at going away for a long time. No surprise. Once they dragged him down to the station, he wanted to make a deal. They asked him what he had to trade, and he offered up a lot of low-level bullshit. Mixed in there, though, was something interesting. He says he was casing an empty warehouse over the weekend and had planned to come back and hit it. The only problem was that when he did, it wasn't empty anymore. This time, it was occupied.
Occupied by whom? Asked Harvath.
According to the metal thief, a handful of white guys with guns, but not just any guns. Small automatic weapons. Look to the thief like submachine guns. He says there were also four metal boxes, like kennel crates. He thought maybe these guys were into dogfighting or smuggling exotic animals or something. But then he caught a glimpse of what was inside one of the boxes.
People, said Harvath.
Correct. We think this could be it. SWAT and FBI are already being scrambled. Where's Sal?
He's still at the garden court scene, replied Cordero.
Call him. I want you both at the warehouse when this goes down. It could end up being a real feather in our cap. I don't want it screwed up. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Chapter 56. Cordero's partner arrived at the staging area about 10 minutes after she and Harvath got there. The SWAT team already had surveillance on the warehouse, and they were putting together their entry plan in consultation with the FBI. A restaurant supply company had been kind enough to allow them to pull their vehicles inside its building in order to avoid detection. Mixed in with the uniformed SWAT team members were a handful of plainclothes operatives. With their short haircuts and muscled builds, none of these guys looked like run-of-the-mill folks from the neighborhood. None of them would be able to walk up to the warehouse. They'd have to hit it fast and hard before anyone inside knew what was happening. If the men inside were the caliber of professional that Harvath suspected they might be, they were going to put up one hell of a fight. The SWAT team needed to know what they were potentially going up against. Harvath took advantage of a break in their briefing to pull the team commander aside and share his concerns. The man listened to what he had to say, thanked him, and then updated his officers. As they continued with their planning, one of their spotters radioed in. So far, the warehouse was dead. They had even managed to get an operator up on the roof near the skylights, where the metal thief had allegedly seen everything, and there was still no sign of activity inside. It was too quiet. Either the thief had lied, or somehow the men inside knew they were coming. The SWAT team's greatest concern was the safety of the hostages. Not knowing where they were being held made the officer's job incredibly difficult. The moment the team made entry into the warehouse, if they didn't move fast enough, it was a very real possibility that the kidnappers would kill the hostages. Balancing officer safety against the two innocent lives they believed might be inside was like dancing on a knife blade. There was only one good outcome, and no shortage of bad ones. The commander was meticulous and refused to rush anything. He called in additional assets and did everything he could to maximize their surveillance. Finally, he made the call. It was time to hit the warehouse. After one last check of their radios, weapons, and equipment, the SWAT team mounted up. The owner of the restaurant supply company offered the plainclothesman use of one of his vans. The fact that it belonged to a local business so close by would hopefully divert any suspicion away from it. This, of course, was based on a dangerous assumption, that the men inside the warehouse hadn't already noticed they were under surveillance and were not waiting to engage any threat, plain clothes or otherwise, foolish enough to enter the structure. Harvath had been on enough building takedowns to know that while time would slow down for the men on the team, for everyone else, things were going to happen very rapidly. He told Cordero and her partner to get ready to move. They exited the restaurant supply company and decided to drive Sal's Crown Victoria to the warehouse. He had two Rubbermaid bins on the back seat filled with gear, one of which he moved onto the floor to give Harvath a place to sit. Cordero climbed in front. As soon as the FBI agents were in place and the SWAT team had departed the restaurant supply company, they followed. Sal turned up his radio so they could listen to the takedown in real time. When he was half a block away from the warehouse and had it in sight, he pulled to the curb. This was close enough. If bullets started flying, they'd be sitting ducks out front.
"Keep it running," said Harvath,
as he noticed the man reaching for his ignition. Sal nodded, and they stayed glued to the radio. The team practiced excellent communications discipline. Messages were transmitted via predetermined brevity codes. Finally, the warehouse doors and windows were breached, flashbangs were tossed inside, and the SWAT team members made their rapid entry. Harvath's entire body was keyed up. Was this it? Had they tracked down the Sons of Liberty? He hated being outside in a car half a block away. He wished he was on the entry team. Hell, he wished he was leading the entry team into the warehouse. After what seemed like an eternity, more thorough communication started crackling across the radio, as room after room of the warehouse was searched and found to be empty. With the raid and then the secondary sweep of the warehouse complete, the team leader relayed the message.
"The building is secure."
Sal put his vehicle in gear, and they drove up to the front of the warehouse as a handful of SWAT operatives came out the front door. The FBI agents on scene had already begun going in. Harvath looked at one of the SWAT team members as he passed, and the officer shook his head.
"No huts," he said,
which Harvath knew stood for no hostages, no unknowns, no tangos, and no shooters. The raid had been a bust. The team leader met them inside.
"The crates are here," he stated, "but that's it."
"Where are the crates?" Cordero asked.
The man pointed the trio to the back of the building. The crates had been collapsed and leaned against the wall, as if someone was considering taking them along, but then had second thoughts. In another room, where a length of chain hung from the wall, one of the FBI agents had found a woman's blouse. It smelled terrible and was spattered with blood.
Do you have Betsy Mitchell's blood type in your file?
The female detective asked.
If it's not, said Harvath, they should be able to get it pretty quickly.
She turned to her partner.
Where's your camera?
Out in the car.
I don't want to wait for the CSTs to get here. I want to get pictures, I want to do our drawings, and then let's start bagging things up for analysis, okay?
Fine by me, said Sal. We'll need to coordinate the bureau folks and set up a canvas, in case anyone else around here saw anything. Plus, we should see if we can get a better description of the men the metal thief says he saw.
What can I do?
Asked Harvath.
Do you have any forensics experience?
Cordero asked.
He shook his head.
Not much. Then I have the perfect job for you, she replied. Go out in the car and bring those two Rubbermaid bins in.
Then what?
Then you're really going to prove your worth to this investigation.
How?
He asked.
You're going to find us coffee somewhere in this neighborhood.
Chapter 57. To his credit, Harvath not only didn't mind going out for coffee, he actually found some, and it wasn't half bad. He returned with three cups in a cardboard tray. The evidence techs still hadn't arrived yet, but Cordero had made a significant find.
Check this out,
she said, holding up a clear plastic bag. Inside, there was a piece of black cardstock the size of a business card. On one side, printed in blood red, was a skull and bones with a floating crown. On the other side were the words, I glory in publicly avowing my eternal enmity to tyranny. It was followed by the letters S-O-L.
I think that's a line from John Hancock, said Harvath.
Sal held up his smartphone. Correct. Part of the speech he gave on the 4th anniversary of the Boston Massacre.
Why is it printed on a card? And why leave it here?
Maybe it was left by accident, said Cordero.
Where'd you find it?
Behind where the crates were stacked up against the wall.
She had a point. Maybe it had been left by accident. One thing was for certain, though. Finding this warehouse was a huge breakthrough. At least, he hoped it would be.
What else have you been able to find?
He asked.
Other than that card and the blouse, replied the female detective.
Nothing. There's got to be something more here. We just haven't found it yet.
You're welcome to look around, said the male detective. If you find anything, just don't touch it. Call one of us or one of the FBI agents.
Harvath nodded and went to the other end of the warehouse. He was used to hitting terrorist safe houses where the kind of evidence he was expected to collect were things like thumb drives, CDs, and written documents, not hair and fiber samples. Finding the card with a Hancock quote, though, had been huge. They were definitely in the right spot. The only question was, had any other clues been left behind? Once the crime scene techs arrived, they would go through the laborious process of dusting for prints. Undoubtedly, they'd find a ton, and he didn't envy the person or persons who would be charged with having to run all of them down. Considering a building of this size with this many surfaces, the question wasn't what to dust, but what not to. He figured they'd do the obvious items like the crates, the chain attached to the wall near where the blouse was found, the door handles, the light switches, and any bathroom surfaces. Other than that, it was anybody's guess, though he knew there was a strict procedure both the police and FBI followed. What he was looking for as he walked through was something out of the ordinary, something that didn't belong, or something that was conspicuous because it wasn't there. Whoever had been using this location had probably been here since the early hours of Monday morning. That was only 2 days ago. If they were careless enough to leave one of those cards behind, where else had they screwed up? Was the blouse a mistake? Or was it left on purpose? Or did they simply not care about it? The fact that the metal thief had seen multiple males in the warehouse backed up the theory that they were dealing with a team. The fact that they were carrying what looked like submachine guns bolstered the hypothesis that they were well-trained, possibly even aligned with a military or intelligence organization. Add to that the way in which the victims had been killed, particularly the ear removal of Claire Marcourt and Kelly Davis, and it looked like Bill Wise's swim club was a real potential factor in this entire thing. As Harvath continued to walk the building, his mind was drawn to the passage on the back of the card from John Hancock. As he had been laying out the timeline for Cordero, the Boston Massacre was the next big event he was going to mention before her commander had interrupted them. What if the killer's next murder scene wasn't going to be Boston Common or Faneuil Hall, where the two regiments of British troops had stayed, but the actual site of the Boston Massacre? The more he thought about it, the more the idea began to crowd out all other possibilities. The line from Hancock had to be tied to where the killer was going to strike next. It had to be. The only question that remained was whether they should spend any more time at all in the warehouse, or turn it over to the evidence techs and try to get a jump on the next location. Actually, there wasn't any question at all. Giving up his search, Harvath turned around and walked quickly back to find Cordero. If they did this right, they might be able to set up a trap and have the killer walk right into it. Chapter 58. A circle of cobblestones with a star carved into the center was all that marked the location of the Boston Massacre. It sat embedded in a downtown sidewalk, almost directly beneath the east balcony of the old State House. It was one of the least glamorous but most important stops along Boston's Freedom Trail, a 2.5-mile-long red stripe that runs through the city and connects 16 historically significant sites in the run-up to the Revolutionary War. On that spot, 5 Bostonians became the first to give up their lives for the cause of American liberty. Waiting for a group of tourists to pass, he looked at Cordero and her partner and said,
"The symbolism here is pitch perfect, right up their alley. This has got to be where the next one is going to happen." "What do you think, Sal?" Cordero asked.
"My smartphone isn't so smart when it comes to predicting what people are going to do. I don't know."
She looked back at Harvath.
"Do you think they'd stage something from inside the old State House? Another hanging, maybe? Have the body come out over the balcony?"
Harvath looked up and considered it.
"We know they like to operate late at night. It gives them cover. They also like to limit their exposure. That's why the Liberty Tree and Hutchinson sites were done inside. It's pretty hard to kill somebody out in public."
Cordero's partner looked up at all the office buildings surrounding them.
"Maybe not. What if they used a sniper?"
It was a good point. Harvath hadn't thought of that, and now looked up as well. There were plenty of places a sniper could be positioned. It would be dramatic and draw a lot of attention. It also felt like something the people he believed they were dealing with would be capable of. Playing devil's advocate, he said,
"If they did use a sniper, how would they get the victim to walk right up to where they wanted?"
"If it were me," Cordero mused, "I'd put a cop there."
"You would?"
She nodded.
"I'd call something into 911, wait until the cop was right where I wanted him, and then I'd turn the victim loose."
Harvath thought about that.
"Make the victim think you were setting him free?"
"Or her free," she clarified. "Remember, we've got one man and one woman who are still missing."
"That's correct. So you'd let him or her think they're being set free, you'd dump them on the street someplace close, and then tell them to run for the cop."
"Then, when they get to the cop," Sal said, mimicking a sniper with an invisible rifle, "end of story."
It was an excellent theory, but just that, a theory. He looked up again at the buildings. It was a base worth covering.
"How much of a SWAT presence could we get?"
"We can reach out to the state guys to augment what we already have," said Cordero, as her eyes scanned the area. "But not knowing precisely what these people have planned, we also need to flood this entire zone with plainclothes cops. If the victim makes it to that historical marker, it could be too late."
Harvath agreed.
The Boston Massacre was all about British soldiers mowing innocent people down with muskets. So if they do go the sniper route, they'll have the victim in the crosshairs the entire time. Nevertheless, we need to cover our other bases.
"Such as?"
"We definitely want to have officers positioned inside the old State House," he said, as his mind sifted through the countless possibilities.
When you had a location, particularly one out in the open, you learned how to defend it by envisioning how the bad guys would likely attack it. Looking down at the historical marker, he added,
"Is there anything running underneath here? Sewers? The subway system?"
"Probably. Why?"
"Just in case this historical marker isn't really on the site of the Boston Massacre, but actually above it, We'll need cops down there covering it as well.
Well, that shouldn't be too hard to find out, Cordero replied. What else do we need?
It was odd to have her suddenly defer to him, and it took a moment for him to realize that the shift had happened. Maybe it was because she knew that he had been a Secret Service agent, though she had no idea it was on the president's detail. But somehow, she sensed that this was in his wheelhouse and was something he was good at. He thought through all the other things he would like to have, knowing they'd never get there in time, and settled on the one thing they needed more than anything else.
If you can find us a whole busload of luck, that'd be all I'd ask for, he said, forcing an optimistic laugh.
Harvath heard Cordero's partner laugh, but as he looked up, he couldn't tell if the man was laughing with him or at him. Chapter 59. Betsy Mitchell felt the vehicle, probably a van of some sort, based on the sliding sound the door had made once they had gotten into it, bump and jostle along through traffic. She had no idea where they were. Based on the drugs she had been given and all of the takeoffs and landings of the plane she had been on after her abduction, she had no idea if she was even in the United States anymore. She could hear car horns outside, but she couldn't see anything. A hood had been placed over her head. Despite a split lip and an eye that felt painfully swollen from the blows she had suffered, the rape Betsy had feared back at the warehouse never happened. After tearing away her blouse, the man in the mask had left the room. He came back with a small camera and microphone combination, a third the size of a lipstick tube, and showed it to her. He then taped it to her chest, and that was when he had placed the hood over her head. As he removed the collar from around her neck and began to dress her, he used the digital recorder to relay a message explaining what was about to happen. Her ransom had been agreed on. Within a matter of hours, she would be free, if she did everything she was supposed to do. That was the purpose of the video camera and microphone. Though she couldn't see it with the hood over her head, she could feel him adjusting her clothes around it. He explained that he would be able to see and hear everything she did. He also explained what would happen if she veered even one inch from her instructions. Her blood froze in her veins. Once she found her voice again, she swore she would do exactly as he asked. She promised them that in no condition would she waver from what she had been told to do. When the voice on the digital recorder asked her to repeat the rhyme she had been taught, she did, repeating it perfectly, word for word. Once he was satisfied that she was ready, he had loaded her into the vehicle and they departed. She lost track of how long they had been driving. It could have been an hour, it could have been 10. All she could think about was doing everything he demanded, exactly as he had demanded it. All she wanted was her freedom. All she wanted to do was go home. The vehicle turned for the umpteenth time, but began to slow, and then eventually pulled over to the side and stopped. The man with the mask joined her in the back of the van and removed her hood. His eyes bored into hers for several moments before he produced the digital recorder and pressed play. The words she had first heard it speak poured forth again. Please repeat after me. Lucy Lockett lost her pocket. Sally Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, just a ribbon round it. Betsy dutifully complied. The man then rewound the recording and played it again. Betsy repeated the phrase again. In fact, she kept repeating it. It was her mantra. If she said it enough times, she would be free. The man in the mask produced a knife and cut the nylon easy cuffs from her wrists and ankles. Then, tapping her chest to remind her of the camera, he slid open the door and gestured for her to step out onto the sidewalk. Wherever in the world she was, it was evening. That was all she knew. Her instructions had been quite specific. With her hand first in the right pocket of her coat, and then the left, she began walking away from the van. As she walked, she continued to repeat the rhyme over and over again, hoping the man in the mask hadn't lied to her. Lucy Lockett lost her pocket. Sally Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, just a ribbon round it. Here you go, Cordero said,
handing Harvath the bottle of water she had just purchased for him.
See anything new?
Harvath took the water from her and screwed off the cap.
Nothing yet. What did the SWAT commander say?
He asked the same thing he did an hour ago. How much longer do we think this is going to go on?
What did you tell him?
I told him not to worry. His team will be home for Christmas.
Harvath smiled. At least she still had her sense of humor, but it was fading. It had taken all day to set the operation up, most of it with the FBI going back and forth with their headquarters in Washington as to how everything should be handled. A lot of time, in Harvath's opinion, had been wasted on where everyone should be placed, how many Boston PD versus FBI agents should be in plain clothes, etc. By the time everything was settled, it was already late afternoon.
These kind of ops aren't easy, he said, referring to Cordero's interaction with the SWAT team leader. Scanning rooftops and windows is mind-numbing work. You can burn out fast and lose your edge. The commander is just looking out for his guys.
Like I said, they'll all be home for Christmas.
Harvath nodded. Everyone was on edge, their nerves a bit frayed. They were anxious for something to happen. And unlike other types of stakeouts, they had to keep moving. Cordero's partner had helped coordinate changes of clothes, so she and Harvath could rotate in and out of the area with different appearances. He was also coordinating the plainclothes cops and FBI agents. There had already been a couple of false alarms as people bearing a similar resemblance to Jonathan Renner or Betsy Mitchell had passed by. It had sent everyone into high alert mode, only to turn out that it wasn't the people they were looking for. As the evening wore on, Harvath could see the fatigue begin to eat away at the corners of Cordero's mind.
What if somehow we tipped our hand? She asked. What if they figured out we're here?
Harvath looked at his watch.
It's still way too early for you to be going soft on me.
I'm not going soft, but what if I'm right?
You know, I once lay in a hole, not much bigger than the trunk of a car, for 4 days waiting for the right guy to go past. I didn't have a cafe half a block away with cold sodas and a bathroom so clean, people from the third world would think they were at the Ritz-Carlton.
I guess it could be worse, she admitted.
Yeah, there could be snakes and truckloads of guys shooting at you.
Cordero looked at him.
At some point, you and I are going to have a long talk about who you actually are.
Harvath took a sip of his water and screwed the cap back on.
We'll have to do it over coffee. You'll need it to keep awake.
Somehow, I doubt that.
Harvath was just about to change the subject when a voice crackled over their earpieces. It was Sal. We just got a heads up from the patrol officer in the area, he said.
What is it?
Cordero asked. Seems he found a couple of cods like the one you found in the warehouse.
Where is he?
Hold on, said Sal. I'll get him on this frequency. A moment later, the male detective said, You're on with Detective Cordero. Go ahead.
Detective Cordero, a voice said, this is Officer Kaczynski.
What have you got, Kaczynski?
We were told to keep our eyes peeled for anything with a skull and crossbones on it with a crown on top. I've found several black cods with a skull and bones on one side, and the sentence, I glory in publicly avowing my eternal enmity to tyranny, followed by the letters S-O-L.
Harvath tucked his water bottle into his pocket and looked at Cordero.
What's your location?
She asked the patrolman.
I'm headed north on Devonshire, almost at Quaker Lane.
She looked at Harvath and said,
He's about half a block south.
There's a whole bunch of these things, like a trail of breadcrumbs. I've been picking them up in case your guys can get a print off one of them.
Officer Kaczynski, Harvath interrupted, leave the rest of them. We need to know who is dropping them.
Okay, stand by. Let me see what I can do.
Cordero started to move in Kaczynski's direction. But Harvath gently grabbed hold of her arm.
Somebody may be trying to smoke us out. Let's wait a second.
We may not have a second,
she said, as she radioed the other teams and told them what was going on and to be ready. Seconds later, one of the SWAT officers came over the radio and said,
I think we've got it. Looks like some kind of a homeless person, possibly female. Brown hair, heavy brown coat, dark pants. She's dropping something from her pockets.
Can you see Patrol Officer Kaczynski?
Cordero asked.
Roger that, the SWAT officer replied. He's approximately 10 meters behind her.
Kaczynski, Cordero said over her radio, do you see a female homeless woman approximately 10 meters ahead of you? Brown hair, brown coat?
That's affirmative, Kaczynski replied.
Not only can I see her, I can smell her. Sweet Jesus, it's terrible.
Do not engage. I repeat, do not engage. They may be trying to smoke us out,
the female detective ordered as she looked at Harvath.
What the hell is going on?
I've got no idea, he said, but I don't like it. Something feels very wrong about this.
Cordero radioed the other team members.
Everybody on your toes. The woman in the coat might be a decoy. Keep your eyes peeled on our other ingress points. If one of our targets is being sent in, we don't want to miss him or her.
Harvath's eyes continued to scan the area. He paid particular attention to the historical marker and kept looking toward Devonshire Street. Suddenly, he saw the woman in the brown coat. Kaczynski's voice came back over their earpieces.
This woman is crackers. I can hear her repeating some rhyme about someone called Lucy Lockett or something.
Officer Kaczynski, Cordero warned. Do not engage her. Is that clear?
10-4.
She's headed our way, said Harvath.
The female detective could see her now. The woman's hair was a rat's nest. She walked with her head down. Like many homeless people, she was overdressed for the warm weather in a winter coat.
She's almost to you, said Kaczynski. We see her, Cordero replied.
Both she and Harvath could now clearly see her reaching into her pockets, pulling out the black cards and dropping them in her wake. Harvath's feelings of unease were continuing to build. His gut was telling him something. He just couldn't put his finger on it. The woman walked like she was in a dream, mumbling as she moved forward, placing one foot in front of the next. Harvath had seen this before. Where?
Why was it so familiar?
The alarm bells were going off full force in his head now. Cordero took a step in the direction of the woman. Harvath reached out and grabbed her arm again. They watched as the woman stepped out into the street. As she did, a car speeding through the intersection slammed on its brakes. The woman looked up. One of the SWAT team members watching through a spotting scope identified her first.
Target A. Target A. The woman in the brown coat is Betsy Mitchell. All teams, the woman in the brown coat is Betsy Mitchell.
Cordero shook off Harvath's hand and began running. So did Officer Kaczynski. Kaczynski got to Betsy Mitchell first, knocking her to the ground and throwing himself on top of her. Harvath got to Detective Cordero, just as the suicide vest Betsy Mitchell was wearing was remotely detonated. Chapter 60.
What the hell was that?
Bill Wise asked as Ryan and McGee rushed to the hotel room window. Ryan got there first.
It sounded like an explosion.
It sure as hell felt like one, McGee added.
They could see an enormous roiling fireball climbing up into the night sky. The shockwave had been so powerful, it had almost blown out their windows. And as best they could tell, they were a good 4 or 5 blocks away. Moments later, the sound of emergency vehicles racing to the scene began to fill the air.
I hope that wasn't a bomb, said Wise. That's the last thing Boston needs. We should check it out.
No way, replied McGee. If it was a bomb, there could be a secondary waiting to go off as first responders get there. Besides, it's not our problem.
Give it time, Ryan stated. As they stood looking out the window, you'd be surprised how fast problems metastasize when Tom Cushing is around.
Speaking of Cushing, Wise replied, can we finalize everything now that we're here?
After interrogating Samuel, Wise had contacted Reed Carlton, who showed up with two rather large men and a female operative named Sloan. Samuel had admitted that he had a second target, a former swim club doctor named Jim Gage. While Sloan and one of the men were dispatched to take Gage into protective custody, Wise warned Carlton about Samuel and provided detailed instructions for where and how he should be held. He then shared what they had learned from the interrogation.
One of the most significant elements, but hardly the most surprising, was that Phil Durkin had held on to several covert programs after the agency had ordered them shut down. He would go through the steps of firing everyone and closing up shop, but then he'd go back out and rehire the personnel he wanted while he shoved each operation further into the shadows, taking them all full black. Through some untraceable funding source, he had managed to keep everything afloat and operational. Those who didn't know anything figured Durkin was providing plausible deniability for his superiors. No one knew exactly how many programs he was overseeing, but the whisper on the black ops side was that he had cobbled together his own shadow agency. Bill Wise didn't know how much of what Samuel shared was actual fact and how much was office gossip. Nevertheless, rumint, or rumor intelligence, was something any good operative was expected to be attuned to. Another significant piece of intelligence was that Ryan's old team was still active and still being led by a man named Tom Cushing. Samuel admitted to having conducted a handful of operations for them. According to Samuel, Phil Durkin liked the way Cushing operated and had elevated his status in the black ops community, feeding him more and more assignments and entrusting him with more and more responsibilities. Cushing, though, wasn't Bill Wise's concern. At least, he hadn't thought so until he asked Samuel if he knew anything about what was going on in Boston. That was when Ryan had stiffened. When the interrogation was complete, Wise had asked to speak to her privately. When he confronted her, Ryan admitted that she and McGee had traced Cushing along with two other team members there. Now that they had arrived in Boston, Wise wanted to know how they were going to nail them. Ryan stepped away from the window and pulled a large envelope from her bag.
"We're going to nail them with this."
Wise looked at her.
"I don't follow."
"You know the old line, how do you eat an elephant?"
"One bite at a time."
"Correct," Ryan replied. "One of the last bites of our elephant is going to be Phil Durkin. Before we get to Durkin, we have to go through Tom Cushing."
Wise interrupted her.
"At this point, though, I want Cushing more than I do Durkin. If Cushing is behind these murders and he's using a killer from Swim Club to do it, we need them stopped ASAP."
"As long as we take Cushing alive, that's all I care about. I need answers out of him to take to the Jordanians."
"My team is going to want answers out of him, too," said Wise, referring to Carlton, Harvath, and their client, the Federal Reserve. "I don't think it's an accident that our paths have crossed."
McGee chuckled as he turned away from the window. "It's lucky for you that they did. If we hadn't shown up, Samuel would be picking his teeth with your bones right about now.
For which I am eternally grateful. Now, how are we going to handle Cushing?"
"That's where the banking records come in," said Ryan,
as she walked over to the couch with her envelope and sat down.
"I don't know what it was like when you were there, but the CIA is terrible when it comes to funding their people in the field. They're always months in arrears, and it can really screw things up. You learn early on that robbing Peter to pay Paul is the only way to keep your sources funded. Some intel people have been forced into fronting their own personal money just to make sure things get paid on time and they don't lose assets."
"So?"
"So, this thinking gets pretty ingrained. Once you have a steady flow of funds, particularly if it comes through a front organization, there's this kind of fuck the agency mentality that surfaces. You never stick your hand in your own pocket again. In fact, you may even start putting your hand in the agency's pocket. Cushing was very strict about stealing. It wasn't allowed. Setting up hotel and airline mileage accounts, though, was considered an acceptable perk. The idea being that throughout the year, they could build up enough points with which to take personal trips in their off time."
"Assuming they travel under their real names."
Ryan smiled.
"They do. And not only that, but two of Cushing's team, Vaccaro and Stark, checked into their hotel here in Boston using their Hands for Peace corporate credit cards."
"What about Cushing himself?"
"He's there too. Trust me. He's just more compulsive about covering his trail."
"You were talking about eating the elephant one bite at a time. I assume that means you want to start with Vaccaro and Stark, then."
"Yep," she said, holding up the envelope. and you're going to help.
Chapter 61. The Renaissance Boston Waterfront Hotel was exactly the hotel Ryan would have expected her old team to pick. They always chose Marriott properties when they traveled, and one of their requirements was that the hotel have its own workout facility. If the property was just off a major thoroughfare that connected directly with the airport, that was another plus. Finally, if a city offered a higher-end experience like a Renaissance property, and it didn't chafe their NGO cover status too badly, Cushing and Company usually opted for it. Some things never changed. Never changing, no matter how skilled you might be, was a bad trait in the espionage game. With its large aquatic-themed lobby, the Renaissance provided lots of good places from which to see, while not being seen. Ryan had already checked the bar, the restaurant, the hotel Starbucks, and the fitness center without any luck. It was now time to try their rooms. Picking up a house phone, she gave Vaccaro's full name and asked to be connected to his room. There was no answer. She then asked to be connected to Stark. He answered on the second ring.
"Good evening, Mr. Stark," Ryan said. "This is Julie with guest services. An envelope was just dropped off for you. Would you like me to send it up, or should we hold it downstairs?"
Before Stark could answer, she added,
"And I see here in my files that we made a mistake when you checked in. You're one of our most valued Marriott Rewards customers, and you should have received a much more significant welcome gift. I apologize for that. Can I have both brought up to your room for you?"
Stark agreed. Ryan thanked him, and after hanging up the phone, she flashed McGee the peace sign. Walking toward the bell stand, McGee cornered an older bellman standing nearby and asked to borrow a pen. He wrote Stark's name across the front of the envelope and, producing a $50 bill, said,
"I need to get this to my colleague's room ASAP. He's on a big conference call, so please, don't knock. Just slide it under, okay?"
"The last name is Stark?" the bellman asked.
"That's right," McGee replied, and quickly changed the subject. "I'm already late for dinner with a new client. Where can I get a cab? Right out front here?"
The man nodded and was pointing toward the front doors, but McGee had already walked away. The bellman stepped behind the stand, checked his computer for the room number he needed, and then told his colleague he was going to make a delivery. With the envelope in hand, he strode over to the elevators, and after holding the doors open and waiting for a group to step out, he stepped in. The doors had almost shut when he heard a woman ask for the elevator to be held, and a man's hand reached in to stop the doors from closing all the way. The doors slid back to reveal a man who looked like Santa Claus, carrying a gray duffel bag, and a very attractive woman in her mid-30s with a black rolling suitcase.
"What floor do you need?" the bellman asked Ryan.
9, please," said Wise.
The bellman looked at him as if to say, "I was asking the lady first," when Ryan responded,
7, please."
The bellman, who had already punched 7 for his delivery, smiled back at Ryan and then pushed the button for the 9th floor.
"All set."
The man made polite hotel chit-chat on the ride up and wished them both a nice stay as the doors opened on the 7th floor and he stood back to allow Ryan to exit first. As she did, she removed a cell phone Wise had given her and rolled her eyes.
"It wouldn't be a business trip for Mom if I didn't get called 6 times before I got to the room," she said.
The bellman smiled and left her standing at the elevator bank, chastising a pair of imaginary children. She had already marked the location of the nearest stairwell in case the bellman forgot his instructions and knocked on Stark's door, and she needed to beat a hasty retreat. The bellman, though, did as he had been told. Ryan marked the location of the room and began walking in the other direction. Knowing how abundantly helpful bellman can be, or any man for that reason, when presented with an attractive woman, she kept up the intensity of her conversation in order to keep him from offering to help her find a room and get situated. The combination of body language and tone did the trick. The bellman returned to the elevators. Once she had heard the doors close and was sure that he had gone, she radioed McGee and Wise and told them which stairwell to meet her in.
"Now for the fun part," Wise said,
as he fished the can of aerosolized pepper spray from his bag. McGee looked at it. The label said Guardian Protective Devices, and attached to the nozzle was a narrow piece of flexible clear plastic tubing about 18 inches long.
You're like Felix the Cat with that bag. You got that bicycle I wanted for Christmas all those years ago, too?
This is going to be better than Christmas. Just watch.
We're not going to get a flashover with that stuff, are we? I don't want to light this guy Stark up like a Christmas tree unless we absolutely have to.
Wise shook his head.
This is the best stuff the military has ever fielded. Burns like a mother, but it's not flammable.
Whose idea was the hose? Yours?
It was actually their idea. Believe it or not, the inspiration was hotels. Some asshole bangs on your door at 3 in the morning. You slip the hose under the door, spray this into the hallway, and suddenly it's filled with pepper mist and a very inhospitable place to be. We, though, are going to do the opposite.
McGee smiled.
Smoke him out of his room into the hall. I like it.
Wise looked up at Ryan.
You good to go?
She nodded.
Okay, let's go.
The contents of the envelope would only keep Stark busy for so long. It was a page from the Wall Street Journal, with 3 letters crossed out in pencil. Whether or not the team still used the same code, it didn't matter. It would take Stark 15 minutes at least to figure the message out, and to check the online dead drop where further instructions would be waiting. It had been one of the team's emergency protocols, intended to be used only when their primary and alternate codes had been compromised, and for that reason, she had hoped it would work. The one thing that was for certain was that Stark would be in a hyper-vigilant state of alert. That's why it was so important that Wise's plan worked. Readying their gear, they gave everything one last quick check and stepped out of the stairwell. The coast was clear. They moved rapidly down the carpeted hallway and took their positions outside Stark's door. When Ryan and McGee returned his thumbs up, Wise worked the tube underneath the door and then depressed the button, releasing the mist of pepper spray into the room. Stark started coughing in less than a minute. Within 2 minutes, he had opened the window, which was when Wise pumped an even thicker mist into the room. Stark was really hacking now. They heard him tear a towel from the bar in the bathroom and began running the water in the sink. Moments later, they noticed a shadow pass across the peephole. Even if the man could focus, he wouldn't have seen anything in the hall. Wise, McGee, and Ryan were all crouching down, off to the sides, out of sight. Used covertly, pepper spray was very disorienting. If you weren't standing in the middle of a riot or had someone aiming a can at you, its effects were very unsettling and hard to attribute. Your mucous membranes dumped, your eyes drained buckets of water, and your throat, lungs, and eyes burned like crazy. With the wet towel pressed against his face, Stark unlocked his door and leaned out to see what the hell was going on. That was when McGee nailed him with the taser. Chapter 62. The first person Harvath saw as he came to was Cordero's partner. The man's lips were moving, but no sound was coming out. Harvath could hear what he thought was the rustle of the detective's Boston PD nylon windbreaker. He soon realized that it was the rush of blood pounding in and out of his ears. As the detective's voice became discernible, it was accompanied by a loud ringing.
"Are you okay?" Sal yelled.
The man might as well have been yelling across the Charles River. Harvath could barely make out what he was saying, but he got the gist of it. He nodded and waved him off as he sat up and looked for Cordero. It smelled like gasoline and burnt flesh. There were fires burning everywhere. The ground was littered with bodies and broken glass. Sal was about to leave him, and Harvath reached out and grabbed his arm.
"Is she okay?"
he asked.
"Where's Lara?"
A triage area had been set up near a row of ambulances. EMTs were working their way through the dead and wounded, assessing who needed immediate care, who needed immediate transport, and who was beyond being helped. Through his blurred vision, he could just make out Cordero, who was being examined. The male detective waved over one of the other EMTs, who gave Harvath a quick assessment, and then helped him to his feet and walked him over to where Cordero was sitting.
"Are you okay?"
he asked, as he was helped into a sitting position next to her. "Sir," the EMT said to Harvath, "I need to ask you some questions."
"I'm fine. Go take care of everyone else."
"Sir, I understand you were unconscious. I'd like you to follow this light with your eyes." Harvath took out his credentials.
"I'm fine. Please go help someone else."
The EMT treating Cordero looked at his colleague and said, "I got this. Don't worry." The man nodded and went off to treat the next victim of the blast. Cordero looked over at Harvath.
"You saved my life. Are you okay?"
"I'm alive. A little beaten up, but alive. You, though, look terrible."
Harvath reached up and touched his forehead. When he drew his fingers away, they were slick with blood.
"I'm good,"
Cordero said to the EMT.
"Why don't you see to my partner for a minute here?"
"Partner?"
It hurt his sides to laugh, but Harvath did anyway.
"What the hell happened?"
he said. It was a rhetorical question.
"Our guys have cross-trained with the Israeli police and military for years. We always wondered when we'd see our first suicide bomber. I guess we don't need to wonder anymore."
Harvath looked at the EMT.
"Do you have a pair of forceps by any chance?"
The man looked at him askance for a moment, and then removed a pair and handed them to him. He placed his hand gently on Cordero's arm and had her tilt a little bit to her right. Using